Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm going to talk about a subject that I think merits me asking you to grab your beverage of choice, find a quiet place, and dig in with me, because whatever your speciality, or for those of you who aren't doctors, your interest, this is really important stuff, not just some random rant on my part. Today, I'm going to riff on medical ethics, a construct that obviously underpins all medical practice and, in truth, our lives, if we endeavor to be good people, and I'm sure we all do. It's constantly evolving and is always relevant, whether it be who gets access to limited medical resources, abortion, end-of-life care, and on and on and on. And at the moment, with COVID-19, doctors have had to make, well, some pretty tough decisions if there's limited ventilators, for instance. The history of medical ethics is rich and provocative, with a lot of spirited debate punctuating it. Put two doctors in a room and you'll get three opinions. Today, more than ever, with medical science expanding at exponential pace, an aging population and limited resources, it's one of the key pillars upholding the integrity of medical practice and public health. So for this episode, I'm going to do my best to dive into the origins, history, and applications of medical ethics. So first of all, what do we mean by ethics? Well, ethics and morals are often used interchangeably, but they are different. Morals describe values subjective to preference. Ethics refers to moral principles and narrow margins of correct behavior. The ethos, and hence the word, is a system of moral principles. It's what's good for individuals and society as a whole. There are four commonly cited principles of medical ethics, and I'll also argue for a fifth, a bit more of that later. So for medical practice to be ethical, it must represent all four of the following concrete principles. The first of which is autonomy. The patient can make an informed decision, and to be informed, we, the doctors, have to do the informing in a balanced manner, using language that is culturally and educationally appropriate. In and of itself, that is a massive problem, and I'm going to come back to that. The second is justice. Practice must align with the law, doing what is compatible with a person's rights or beliefs as an individual. And again, think about the individual and their rights and their beliefs, not yours. The third is beneficence. Is it good? And the practice has good intentions. For contrast, think Nazi doctors experimenting on human beings. Well, there's clearly no good intentions. The final of the four principles is non-maleficence. It's not of bad intent and does not intend to cause deliberate harm. You could say that beneficence and non-maleficence are one and the same, coexisting, if you will. However, there are contexts in which one should be considered more than the other. For example, is the treatment going to offer more harm than good? That would be a non-maleficent scenario. The patient's emotional and mental well-being, as well as their beliefs and their rights, come into play during non-maleficence. An example of this would be, well, let's say, dealing with a trauma in a patient who's a member of the Jehovah's Witness faith. And as you, I'm sure you know, they have issues with blood transfusion. So what do we do medically if a blood transfusion is indicated in such a patient? It's a challenge. And that leads us into the fifth principle, the scope of application, which is also crucial. It's about understanding when not to act, when not to apply a skill or procedure, because it's wrong for that patient in that situation. You know, I remember being taught as a surgeon by my boss, Sir Robert Shields, that I would spend the first 5 years of my career learning how to operate. I'd spend the next 5 years learning when to operate, and then I'd spend the remainder of my professional life learning when not to operate. There's also the doctrine of double effect, when an action may have a desired benefit, but an undesirable effect. A perfect example, chemotherapy. The desired benefit is that it hopefully cures the cancer. The side effects, the undesirable effect, are things like, well, they're highly undesirable, alopecia, vomiting, exhaustion, diarrhea, and on and on and on. The doctrine of double effect also applies outside of medicine. The most obvious example is war. There may be a perceived noble cause. And, you know, I'm not going to question these because they do change throughout history. I'm sure the Crusaders thought they had a noble cause. More modern examples would be stopping the Nazis, preventing genocide, and so on. But in the process, innocent people are killed, maimed, rendered homeless. The doctrine of double effect. You know, Thomas Aquinas wrote about this in regard to self-defense, which he considered morally proper. Of course, in the process of defending oneself, someone may die. Highly undesirable, but acceptable as long as the intent was not to kill, merely to defend oneself. So let's come back to medical ethics. Everyone's heard of Hippocrates, the Greek physician born on Kos around the 5th century before the Common Era. He supposedly wrote an oath that bears his name, although, spoiler alert, many of us think he did not. This list of rules and pledges contains largely outdated principles sworn to the gods that are, well, inappropriate nowadays. For example, the oath states that physicians should share their income with their teachers. Yeah, well, I don't think that's going to pan out. It also states that you cannot charge fees for teaching. Abortion is out, as is sex with your patients or their household members or slaves. It even implies that surgery contravenes the oath by stating, "I will not use the knife, not even on sufferers from stone." Well, given I'm a surgeon and I venture to state an ethical one, that doesn't resonate with me. But the oath helped build a basis upon which modern medical ethics has grown, and it's been applied and updated to take into account modern social structure. Hippocrates aside, and from a Western perspective, the more familiar medical ethics that we see today started to appear probably in the late 1800s. In fact, in 1892, Dr. William Coley, a surgeon, provided one of the first recorded mentions of consent. It's interesting. Dr. Coley believed that inflammation might reduce cancers and so was researching methods to try and artificially induce inflammation as an anti-cancer strategy. He described one patient who had a large abdominal sarcoma where he offered to administer injections to induce his inflammatory tumor treatment. The patient was initially resistant, but Dr. Coley stated that after some deliberation, he consented. There you go. This was an era where ethics were being considered in research, and in fact, self-experimentation was a key component. After all, if a researcher wouldn't do something themselves, why should they expect anyone else to have it performed on them? And this does raise the issue of what is meant by informed consent. I mentioned that earlier. While a plumber or accountant or lawyer may be very knowledgeable about their field, can they truly understand the nuances of information concerning a given and perhaps very complicated treatment algorithm? Surely the best person to understand this is the researcher themselves, hence the attraction from an ethical perspective of self-experimentation. Of course, there are drawbacks. Think of Halsted, William Halsted, a very famous American surgeon, who developed techniques of local anesthesia by experimenting on himself, and in the process, he became a cocaine addict. Oops! And in 1897, just 5 years later, Giuseppe Sanarelli, an Italian bacteriologist, discovered the bacillus that causes yellow fever, although, of course, we now know that yellow fever is not caused by a bacillus, but by a mosquito-borne virus. Sanarelli claimed that he'd produced yellow fever in 5 patients, and when he presented this data, he was condemned by one of the most prominent physicians in the world, Sir William Osler from Johns Hopkins, who said, "To deliberately inject a poison of known high degree of virulence into a human being, unless you obtain that man's sanction, is not ridiculous, it's criminal." Modern medical ethics adhere to the 5 principles that I mentioned earlier, but differ to some degree based on the perspectives of the people involved. So let's look at a few examples. The code of ethics for physicians has evolved, and I reference the change in the oath. But generally speaking, the behaviors of modern-day physicians must adhere to the following. We must provide honest advice. Well, that can be a challenge because it can be incredibly difficult to tell someone the truth, not only due to their educational status, but their age, their illness, their situation, their emotions, and what they want to know. Some patients don't want to know and may tell you that, in fact. Consent. Well, I mentioned that earlier. To receive informed consent, how informed does the patient need to be to make the decision? And how can any patient obtain true informed consent? It's clearly something that has bugged me for years. And I think it's a bit of a fallacy in truth. Now, obviously, there are clear-cut examples, if you'll forgive the pun. Someone who has got a gangrenous leg and you're going to provide them ethical, informed consent. Do you keep your leg or do you allow me to amputate it? It's, you know, it's not much of a decision. You have to provide an honest description of the experience. And that's really tricky when a patient asks you, what would you do? And, you know, the simple answer is say, well, I'm not you. I don't live your life. I don't have your expectations. It's different for me. But we've got to do the best we can to provide an honest description with all the necessary caveats. And here's a biggie. Here's a biggie. And this is something that I've ranted on about before on many occasions. A declaration of conflicts of interest. I've talked about this before, and it still rankles me. I'll give you an example. If I invent something that has been shown to improve outcomes in medical practice, I obviously want to use that on my patients. But what if I get paid royalties by a company who's brought it to market? How does that change things? Well, surely declaring that conflict is a key step. And I can also choose to not receive royalties on any devices or drugs that I personally prescribe or use. The problem is the very perception of conflict of interest has people's, I don't know, their hackles rise. It's something that I think merits a proper, very public debate. So moving away from medical practice to the educational sector, you're listening to this podcast. This comes to you via an educational service. Educational sector in healthcare has some principles that it needs to adhere to. The first is honest peer review. It's the basis by which evidence finds its way into the literature. There also has to be a division between what is editorial and what is business for a journal. And that has to be clearly stated. And there have to be suitable disclosures of conflict of interest and author affiliations. And we need proper quality control so that, for instance, there's no disconnect between what's in the abstract and the content of the paper. And you're probably asking, why am I saying that? Well, because data demonstrate that very often that is the case. And I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that authors are deliberately conniving. I think what happens is during the peer review process, changes are made to the manuscript and someone forgets to change the abstract. But that's something that has to be done. There also has to be a willingness to withdraw articles where errors have surfaced, be they acts of commission or omission. We've seen a lot of that during the time of COVID with this whole pre-publication approach to medical literature. And frankly, we need to see more willingness to publish negative results. And we do have to police predatory practices in publishing, conferences, and authorship, where, for instance, renowned names are leveraged for commercial intent. I've mentioned research a little earlier, and it's another huge slice of the medical ethical pie with solid guidelines and principles. For instance, you've got to have proper governance of all elements of research. You've got to have good design and practice of clinical trials. We have to protect participants from harm. We have to report data with honesty and integrity. We have to scrupulously avoid conflicts of interest. And we have to have proper informed consent to research. In fact, I would posit that a consent form for a clinical trial is always going to be much more detailed than a consent form for a major surgical procedure. And of course, total respect for subject confidentiality. You know, there can be huge implications when medical ethical principles are not practiced and followed. And I'm going to give you a few notable examples. Cyril Burt, whose work on IQ in the, I believe, 1970s, turned out that not only were his results fabricated, but he also fabricated co-authors who later research demonstrated didn't even exist. There was the work by Dr. John Darcy on cardiomyopathy in the early 80s, fallacious results. And of course, and I've talked about this on this podcast, the work by Andrew Wakefield, which introduced and then perpetuated vaccine hesitancy. You think about the implications of that. People have not had vaccines for things like measles, mumps, measles, and rubella, the MMR vaccine. And people have gotten measles, and I'm sure people have died on the basis of fallacious, unethical work. There was the work from, the 2000s by Dr. Agarwal on curcumin, which supposedly had anti-cancerous properties. People make decisions about their malignancy based on what they read. And if the work is inaccurate, well, it's bad enough if it's an act of omission. You got something wrong. Lord knows, doctors get things wrong. But when things are purposefully disseminated that are inaccurate, purposefully, that crosses the line. That's unethical. And of course, then in the tragic case of the Tuskegee study in the United States, where syphilis in the African-American population in Alabama went untreated to see what happened. I mean, it's unconscionable. Failure to adhere to a medical ethical structure in clinical practice, research, and education is not only morally reprehensible, it erodes trust in our profession. And as I've suggested, can lead to bad outcomes and even deaths of those very people that we are sworn to protect. There has to be a commitment to a culture of ethical behavior with appropriate oversight, proper documentation, and the opportunity to revisit and amend, because ethics evolve as society and circumstances change. I know I've gone on for a bit, but I'm pretty passionate about this, and that just about wraps it up for today. But I hope that this brief foray has inspired you to think about the basis and the principles of ethical practice. Please do join me again next Friday for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast, where instead of me rambling on, I'll have a wonderfully engaging guest. And in the meantime, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please like us on social media, tell your friends and colleagues, and pop in for the next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well. Bye for now.